Mark chapter 10, verse 35 to 52. In the Orange Bible, it is 10:15,015, and Journaling Bible, it is 763. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "what we want you to do for us, whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he said. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and other at your left in your glory." "You don't know what are you asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Then they came to Jericho. As Jesus, his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, which means son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he is calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," said Jesus, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road.
Thank you, very well read. Please keep that open. I'd like to pray as we start. And I'm going to use that verse that the blind man Bartimaeus said. "Rabbi, we want to see." Please, Lord God, by your Spirit, may our eyes be opened to who Jesus is, to why he came, and to what it means to follow him. Please grow us in our discipleship. And for any who have not yet seen Jesus truly, please open their eyes. Amen. I spent a weekend fell walking in the Lake District with a church crowd from the Midlands a few years ago. What made it memorable was being with Alan. Alan had started to lose his sight in his 20s, and now he was 50 and he was completely blind. But that didn't stop him enjoying the great outdoors. He covered the same ground the rest of us did, up from Buttermere, over High Stile and back down through the Blacksail Pass, if you know that walk. Anyone know that walk? It was long.
There's a picture of it.
7 hours. With some very challenging terrain, he was fit and hugely appreciative of the company. So how did he do it? Well, he gently rested his hand in the crook of his guide's elbow and walked just behind them. If you were that helper, and we took it in turns, you had the joyful task of describing the views to Alan as you went along, so he could sort of see them. Stunning drop off to the left with the lake just in sight, some purple in view on the far hills. We were constantly amazed that he could judge whether he should be stepping up or down just by the slightest change in his helper's gait. We occasionally slowed down over the really slabby rocks, but he took everything at the same pace as the rest of us. It was amazing. Blind man walking in the Lake District. A remarkable experience, and it gave me a tiny sense of what a blind person might very surprisingly still be able to see. And I mention Alan because in the account Mark gives us in chapter 10, what you have are seeing people who are still in the dark and a blind person who sees better than anyone else. Two sighted people who are blind and a blind person who can see. We know we are meant to compare these two incidents because Jesus asks both the disciples and the blind man the exact same question. Look down and see if you can see what it is. Verse 36 and verse 51, what does Jesus ask them both? Hands up when you get there. Katrina's there. Richard's there. Well done. Chloe's there. He asks them, what do you want me to do for you? And so as we start this morning, it's worth asking yourself, what is it that you want Jesus to do for you? Really do ask yourself that question right now. You're here in church, you're with other Christians, you're doing the Christian thing, but what do you want Jesus to do for you? What would you love more than anything else for him to give you? What would you say to him if he asked you that question? What do you want me to do for you? Maybe you'd say, I'd like relief from my pain. I'd like my relative to get better. I'd like a job. I'd like a better job. I'd like my spouse to appreciate me. I'd like to be free of anxiety. I'd like some sleep. I'd like a bit more in the bank. I'd like, I don't know, you fill it in. Those are all perfectly understandable desires, and they are one type of answer you could give. But Jesus is, I think, looking for a different type of answer altogether. What would you like me to do for you? We like underdog stories, where the favorite comes in last and the underdog comes out on top. I guess it's a bit like Joanna's stories, actually. The tortoise and the hare was what I was thinking of, rather than Doctor Who or whatever that. Deputy Dog? Danger Mouse. That Danger Mouse. Well, chapter 10 of Mark, verse 35 to 52, is like that. And the key to understanding what we're meant to be taking away from them is right in the middle. Let's read verses 44 and 45. Whoever wants to be first must be the slave of all. For even the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's where we'll come back to in a moment. But let's have a look at the event that comes first. And my heading for this is, don't miss why Jesus came and be a glory thief. Jesus and the disciples have set out for Jerusalem, the very place where everyone knows his presence will stir up a hornet's nest of opposition. Things are going to get really nasty. Everybody knows that. And Jesus has only just been giving his disciples a study day on what to expect. He has said, chapter 9, verse 30, I am going to be arrested and tried and killed. But it seems James and John, the two brothers, their sons of Zebedee, have not felt any sadness or fear or grief at what they've heard. Instead, they've jumped ahead a few steps and they've thought, well, how can we play this to our best advantage? I know, let's ask Jesus ahead of time for the top seats. Seats next to Jesus in his glory. What are seats next to Jesus? They are thrones. They are asking to be sat on thrones next to Jesus. Let's ask him before any of the others do, is what James and John's have done. The only two top seats. Do you see that's what's happening? Verse 35, teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Which always is a warning bell kind of question when your kids ask you that. Will you say yes? Jesus patiently asked them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they say, verse 37, "Let one of us sit on your left and one on your right in your glory." That is breathtaking. They are asking, "When you get to Prime Minister, number 10 Downing Street, can we have number 9 and number 11, please? When you get the top job, can we be on either side of you?" Chancellor of the Exchequer, and I don't know what the next job is. It's a power play, and it is glory hunting. It's a maneuver to get advantage over the other disciples, isn't it? It's the kind of thing going on in every office, every team, every political party in the world. Human beings trying to work the angles to get to the top, to get an advantage and come out in front. It's a mindset that we, 2,000 years later, are completely familiar with. And verse 41 shows that it's not just James and John who are at it. Do you see what verse 41 says? "When the 10, the other 10 disciples, heard about this, they became indignant with James and John." Oi! Drat! We should have thought about that. Annoying. Jesus kindly tells them they don't know what they're asking. And then he says something about a cup that he will drink and a baptism that he'll be baptized with. We know now that the route to entering his glory would be through death. That Jesus would very soon be arrested, wrongfully tried, brutally beaten, and then crucified. That's the cup and baptism that he's referring to. Can you be baptized with the cup I'm can you drink the cup I drink? Be baptized with the drink, baptism I'm baptized with? That cup and baptism was unique because of who Jesus is. The Son of God, because of the extraordinary exchange that would be taking place. The sin and the guilt of the world would be being paid for once and for all by the death of the only innocent Son of David, our Messiah and Lord. The punishment that would bring us peace would be upon him. No one else could share in that with him. But when the disciples blindly say, yeah, we can, Jesus said to them, "Well, in a way you will drink and be baptized." Verse 39. Looking forward into the future, Jesus is revealing that he knows that these two, at present still blind men, who don't see the one vital thing that they need to, will one day come to see Jesus for who he is and follow him bravely, even to their own deaths. And then he says, verse 40, "To sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. Those places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." So in essence, the power play you are running, it's a no. So have you heard the term glory thief before? I was reading about it this week and I quite like it. I think it's useful and it's displayed in this episode in very clear light. Jesus is about to come into his glory and the disciples sort of get that, but they don't yet get that the way there will be through his death for sin and his resurrection to life. Jesus is God come into the world to call people to follow him and through faith to receive the eternal life he's holding out to them. So he is the glorious one. He alone is to have the glory. But the way there, the way to the top, so to speak, isn't directly straight up. It is down first. Jesus will suffer and die, and every disciple of his will need to give up on their own selfish ambition, their hunt for glory, their fame and power and prestige for themselves, if they are to be lifted up and share in his glorious future. The problem is, we want the shortcut. We want the glory without the grief. And that makes us glory thieves. Here are James and John seeing Jesus as the one who can give them stuff. And they angle to get it from him. Give us the top seats. Put us ahead of the others. I think people today hear about Jesus, and if they move beyond mockery and disdain for Christians to at least the possibility that Jesus might be who he says he is, they're not there yet. Their thoughts are still very likely to be selfish. Will he give me the comfort and the health or the wealth that is in his power to give me, so that I can enjoy it, so that I can have the glory. That's people's next step. And that has to be dismantled as well. If you see Jesus as a means to an end, like that, and not first and foremost as God come into the world to save you from your sin, to whom you will be eternally grateful and willing to serve whatever it takes, you are a glory thief. And you're on the wrong side of the track. And this passage is as strong a warning that there is, that you need to turn around to repent. That's the Bible word, while you still can. Now, I think glory thieving can seep back into the Christian's life too. We're not immune, once we've trusted Christ with our lives, from selfishly looking out for our own glory and not Jesus's. How do we do that? Well, that little niggling, hidden, selfish desire for our own promotion or position or power or prestige, it still lurks in our hearts and it needs identifying and calling out. The envy of someone else's prominence in church life. Little hints that are dropped looking for praise or credit. The harbored resentment when things don't quite go the way you think they should in church. And a quiet satisfaction when something you cautioned against falls flat. Do you see how all of that is glory thieving? Instead of seeking Jesus' glory and honor and the good of others and their growth, you're concerned about your own. That's James and John in this passage. And Jesus gently says no. Let's look at verse 42 to 45, which are at the heart of the passage. This is Jesus gently but firmly teaching his disciples and all who would follow him. You've got a very stark choice to make, all of you. There are only two value systems, two lifestyles in the world. Ultimately, one is self-service and the other is self-sacrifice. There is only two, and Jesus is calling us to the latter. Self-service or self-sacrifice, what will it be? Let's read verse 42. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Now, the rest of the world just assumes that power and authority is to be sought and taken where you can, because if you don't take it, someone else will and you'll suffer. It's Darwin's survival of the fittest. You take what you can get. And the result is difficult working environments, where everyone, underneath the polite smiles, is worried about who's trying to knock them down and doing their best, at least in the UK, politely knock them off their perch so that they can move up. It's toxic and it burns people out and it leaves people hurt and depressed and angry. And that's just talking about work. I think this happens in marriages too. We live in a world that loves power, and the powerful very often share one trait. They don't listen. They have very little empathy. The power mindset does what it wants to who it wants when it wants. It makes up the rules. It says it's my way or the highway. The will to power is one of the strongest forces in human existence. Those who are regarded as rulers lorded over others and angling for official status so as to exercise authority. When other people have to do what you say, it feels quite powerful, quite alluring and tempting and important and impressive. You can leave a legacy, you can make changes, you can alter the course of history, you can... Well, no one changed anything from underneath. You've got to be on top to make a difference, so I've got to get there. And Jesus says to his disciples then, and to anyone who would come after him ever since, not so. Not so with you. That option is closed to the Christian. You need to resist it with all you've got. Instead, and here Jesus says some of the hardest words in Scripture, and yet some of the most compelling and completely distinctive things he ever said, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slaves. Those who are leaders among you must be your servants. Service, serving others, is where the glory is. It's where the nobility and delight in Jesus is. Jesus washes his disciples' feet to show them what he means. He took off his robes and wrapped a towel round his waist and washed their feet. They are astonished as he does a servant's job for them. But then he says, now you go and do likewise. The towel around the waist is the symbol, the robe of greatness, not the purple cloak of empire power. The steed in the king of the king in Jesus' system is a humble donkey. It's not a Rolls Royce or an armored car. Whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. I haven't got there yet. It was before my time at theological college, but Oak Hill hadn't got the money for ground staff and cleaners at one stage, and there was an appeal that went out around the faculty and the students for volunteers for a whole term who could fill in some of the regular tasks of cleaning and maintenance. People volunteered, some more willingly than others. But the loo cleaning role never had a name against it. In the end, at the end of that term, they realized that the loos had been clean. They'd been cleaned every day. And a bit more investigation revealed that the college principal had been in loo cleaning every morning before any of the students had got up. The principal had been serving the whole college that he was leading. Isn't that amazing? And so like Christ, and so beautiful. But maybe you're saying, no way, Tim, that is too hard a call. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there. You give an inch, you'll be taken for a mile. It just doesn't work. Self-sacrifice does not work. Self-seeking. I know I didn't like the sound of it, but self-sacrifice, that's nuts. Well, let me say that self-sacrifice and service are the way to a happy marriage. If there isn't that in your marriage, it will not be happy. Self-sacrifice and service in the service of a survey of a great set of companies. In this famous book, Good to Great, some of you might have read it, Jim Collins, all the CEOs were looked at very closely and the employees were asked about them. The top five all had bosses who were about the success and improvement of their employees. They were happy to give the credit where it was deserved to others and to stay out of the limelight. Few people know their names. That's the way they like it. Self-sacrifice and service were the drivers in those great companies. Jesus' pattern is not just for Christians, it's for the world. He describes his own mission, verse 45, for even the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom. Not self-service, but self-sacrifice. Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God, come into the world from reigning in heaven, not to rule with a mighty army, but to serve with his life, to give it as a ransom. That is greatness. That is the example he's calling the disciples to. Not, well, what's in there? What's in it for me? What can I get out of this? Rather, what's in it for others? What can I give? We're to be asking ourselves, how can I follow in my Lord's footsteps? And where can I lay my life down for the good of others? Does that idea stick in your throat? Does the prospect of serving others have very little appeal, and the fear of not looking out for yourself fill you with dread? Well, then that must call into account your genuineness in your profession of faith. Because for the one who's received the precious gift of rescue from sin, a sense of goodness of Christ's way will overcome that fear. The excitement and the degree of trepidation for the unknown will be there. Where might God lead me if I go down this route of self-sacrifice? You don't know. But you can trust him because he has proved himself by his dying for you. That he loves you and he will care for you if you follow the one who loves you wherever he leads. Lastly, will you see like a blind man? Verse 46 to 52. They came to Jericho, a blind man. We're told his name. It's gone down in history. Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. He was by the roadside begging. It's dirty and it's shameful. It's a sad place to be in the dust and the dirt, utterly at the mercy of those passing by, easily able to be taken advantage of. But, verse 47, he has one great thing going for him. He understands who this man, Jesus, is. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth coming, he began to shout, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Son of David is a very loaded term. The prophets promised that a son of David would one day come and rescue Israel. And when he came, he would set free the captives. He would feed the hungry. He would heal the sick and give sight to the blind. A majestic description of the Messiah that everyone in Israel was hoping for. Somehow, some way, this blind beggar by the road has understood that this Jesus of Nazareth is that son of David. And so he asks for the one thing all of us should be asking for. What does he ask for? What do you want me to do for you? He asks for mercy. He's not looking for power or authority or position or prestige or money or family or even health at this point. He's asking, he's crying out for, screaming for mercy. You ask for mercy when you know you don't deserve it. Don't you? It's a submission word, crying out to the one who has authority and power to deal any hand to you that he likes. You ask for mercy, and that is asking for his kindness and for grace, for the help that you need and that you are powerless to get for yourself. Look at verse 48. Many shushed him. They rebuked him and told him to be quiet. Shh! But he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." When someone senses that Jesus may have the answers they are looking for and is drawn to him, that is what life is often like. Many people feel compelled to try and shut you up. If you're walking towards Jesus, don't be surprised that other people will be going, "Shh, you're mad. Don't go there. It's nuts. Don't do it." But he shouted all the more. That is for us, it's to read, it's to pray, it's to get among Christians, it's to ask questions, it's not to care less about what other people think of you. If you're being drawn to Jesus, you will stop at nothing to get to him, to know him, to cry out to him, to ask for the mercy you know you need more than anything else. If that's you, good on you. Resist the rebukes and press in towards Jesus and keep going. Verse 49, Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called him. "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he leapt to his feet and came, I don't know if he had a stick, to Jesus. And then that $1,000 question is asked of him, just like it was of James and John. "What do you want me to do for you?" And the blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." The blind man wanted to see in the flesh what he knew in his heart. Jesus, the man standing in front of him who had the power to grant him mercy, he wanted to see him, to have his eyes opened and to follow him. And that is what happened. "Go, your faith has healed you." And immediately he received his sight. And what then? What did the blind man who could see, now that he encountered the man Jesus and been given his sight, what did he do? He did what every disciple is called to do. It wasn't complicated or technical. There were no skills required, no pre-training needed. He followed Jesus along the road. He's left behind his cloak, the one valuable thing he had before, but he's with Jesus. He's infinitely richer than he had ever been before. He's received mercy and he's following the King. So to finish, does that describe you this morning? Happy in following the self-sacrificing servant King, prepared with Jesus to lay down your life in the service of others. You can't offer your life as a ransom. Not the way he could. But you can live a life not of self-seeking, but of self-sacrifice. Not lusting after power, but enjoying giving him the glory. Not being a glory thief, but a disciple, content in the mercy you have been shown, in the sight that you've been given, and keen to share that with others. Will that be us as we leave here this morning? Not self-serving, but self-sacrificing, because we are Jesus' disciples. Perhaps there was an influence in your life, somebody who was just like that, who gave up time and energy and effort to lovingly serve you with the gospel. Perhaps there are ways in which you can share with us that you have seen service in action and want to glorify God for it. Perhaps there's a question or an observation you'd like to make, and now's the time for that. We're not going to get the children just yet. We're going to have questions, and while we're singing the song, we're going to get the children. But Levi's got a microphone. If there's anything by way of encouragement you'd like to share, or thoughts you have, please raise a hand. Laurent, at the back.
Thanks for a very encouraging and challenging message. One thing I experienced in the past is that I would misunderstand this verse as saying that I shouldn't exert authority, even if it's rightful authority, thinking that was a way of thinking this verse. So I was wondering if you could speak to that, maybe in the context of father or not.
It could be read. It looks like it. Let's just find that verse. You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles, verse 42, lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Is Jesus saying all authority is wrong? No, of course he isn't. There is right authority in the world. There is a proper use of that authority, and there are boundaries for that that are healthy and good. It's the self-servingness of it that he is highlighting. It is the, I'm in this for my own power, for my own prestige, for my own glory kind of authority. That can be abused in marriages and in parenting, certainly. But there is a right and good sense of authority that is there in the Trinity, and that should be there in good, healthy structures. So don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's not saying all authority is wrong, but it's saying, what are you in it for? Are you in it for the good, the glory of God, not for yourself? Does that help? Do you want to say something more?
Yeah. What my experience of it was that when I realized authority was right, depending on the position I was in, I realized that I could then use that authority to better serve others. You know, in the context of my children, I actually really serve them by behavior. Don't authority. So, thank you.
Very helpful. Thank you. Kate, please.
Can I just ask a really sort of honest question? Because I sit here and totally agree with everything you said, but having been a Christian since I was 19 at university, I would sit and it's a very familiar passage, and I would like to sit here and say, yeah, I get. I do want to try and reply to Jesus I want to understand your undeserved kindness and grace and help for me. I get all that. But my temptation when it comes to the second question, what do you want me to do for you, is I want you to help me sleep. I want you to take away this horrid anxiety. I want you to keep my 6 children and my husband perfectly safe. I want to control that. You know, those sort of things. That is really real for me this morning. I'm really there. So I think what I've been struggling with, I've just been going through Hebrews this week, and what's really struck me is that whole pattern of consider Jesus, just keep considering Jesus. And I think I just want to say that if anyone else is feeling like that, and I know you would say it as well, Tim, is I think we've just got to keep fixing our eyes on Jesus. We've got to be in his word, which is what, we've got to fall to our knees and just ask for the Spirit's help to bring us that to that point where we can. So this guy said, I want to see, and I want to be able to say that that means for me that I want to see Jesus primarily and to follow him rather than saying the other stuff, which is just
the other
really
stuff is very,
hard in the
very
middle of
real.
The night. Yeah.
The other stuff is very real. We live in a fallen world that we've broken and fallen until Christ comes back. And it's no good hiding the fact that we're struggling. And Jesus is interested in our struggles.
It's absolutely right.
But what Jesus is contrasting the blind man with the disciples here, those two disciples, is their self-servingness about what they want from him. Do I want it for myself just to make me feel better and look better and be happier? Or would these things, if you give them to me, bring me to give you more glory? It may be that he reserves the right to say, you will give me more glory in your thorn experience. And I am nowhere promised that I'll be relieved of some of these struggles in this life. I can hope for and I can pray for and I can ask for lots of things. But my heart needs to be aligned towards him for his glory and others' service. So as we are aligning our thoughts and our minds with Christ for his glory and his service, we are encouraged to pray for the very nitty-gritty, down-to-earth struggles that we're in the middle of. They are good to be conscious of. You can wonderfully, Kate, and actually being honest about struggling is one of the things us Brits found it very hard to do, and actually it warmly allows us to serve one another, which is exactly what Jesus wants us to be doing. So thank you for that. Chloe, last one at the front, I think, before we go and get the youngsters. Thanks, Levi.
Just a quick thing I noticed. If you already feel like you're lost, if you already feel like you're the bottom of the ladder, that doesn't relieve you of your duty to be a servant. Because it's not whoever is first should be last, it's whoever wants to be first should be last. And even if you aren't first, everyone in our human nature desires power. So even if you don't have power, if you're desiring it, that's the problem.
That's a very good observation. I hadn't seen it.